We are continuing our series here, Real Life, as we go through the book of James, a book that really is very practical. It contains a lot of sayings. It doesn't really have a flow to it. That's why I have wisdom up there. It's written in a style that reflects the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, of Hebrews, of Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, that kind of thing. It's also, as we get into, we'll see today, we emphasize the importance of love and action as we talk about faith and works and love and taking it from the theoretical into the practical. As we begin, I have an additional reading here. It's from Luke 18. You can just listen along if you like. It's a short parable that Jesus tells, and I'm not really going to refer to it. I just think it's a good context, sets the context for today's lesson. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee was very religious and stood by himself and prayed, "God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get." But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, "God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, the tax collector, rather than the other, the Pharisee, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and all those who humble themselves will be exalted." Now, as is often the case, if you were here for Bible class this morning, if you were paying attention while Ernest was speaking just now, you probably got the outline of today's sermon. It's interesting, at least for me, as I prepare a sermon and I have my thoughts in a particular text, how often Scripture repeats itself. And so it's not necessarily that we all coordinate, but just that once you have your mindset like, "Oh, I'm going to think on this particular theme today," that almost whatever's said and read, it's like, "Oh, that seems to have that theme in it." Of course, I do have to correct one thing that Ernest said. You know, we are so grateful for all of our kids and young adults who are here today. You are a vital part of the church, and we view your spiritual and physical well-being as an investment in which we are glad to make. All right? Honeycomb, we understand this, okay? As parents, it's in and it's out. Gladly, all right? So, you're the future of the church and the presence of the church. So, that's right. I love you, brother. And I love our kids. I know another church. It's a church where a new couple joined. And this is not one of those preacher stories. This is a true story. A new couple joined the church. They'd been faithful, regular attenders at another congregation and for many years. And they come and join this church. And they get involved because that's what you do when you're part of it. You're used to being part of a church and you've been there a long time. And they had moved from one town. Their house had moved from one town to another. And so they just sort of plugged in and got busy, got involved. They knew some people at this new congregation, not a big church. And all was going along well. The church was glad to have them there. Because it wasn't big, they were stretched thin. And one of the church ministries was a small Christian bookstore that the church ran. And the husband volunteered a day or two to work in the bookstore, which was a great help. And after a year or two of doing this, he started visiting other members and making accusations that the minister was using the bookstore to somehow steal money from the church. And members who'd known the minister for close to 20 years listened to him, and they didn't want to make a fuss. And so they sort of believed him, didn't really question him, but didn't say anything. And certainly didn't approach the minister to have that conversation. Eventually, the minister got wind of this, and it came into the open. And so the church paid a local accounting firm to do an audit of the books of the church, the books of the bookstore, and it was determined that there was no fraud, no misappropriation of funds. The couple stopped attending. But those long-term relationships that had been so strong for 10, 15, 20 years, all those people stayed, and that relationship needed a lot of work to rebuild it. Thankfully, the church and the minister ultimately withstood that attack. The man who made the accusations, other things about his life, came out over the years, and he was discredited, if he wasn't already. But this wasn't the first time that a congregation, and you can think perhaps of your own church history, this wasn't the first time that a church experienced members making accusations against one another. And the motivations will vary. Sometimes the motivations are obvious. Sometimes the people making the accusations don't even understand their own motivations. But slander occurs. And so James, the brother of Jesus, writing 50 years, give or take, after the resurrection of Jesus, addresses similar problems. Think about that. People who sat down and had breakfast with Jesus, who went to the grocery store with Jesus, who were part of the first church and getting this up and running, sat down, wrote a letter, and in chapter 4, verse 11, felt the need to say to the church that he was writing to, "Brothers and sisters, do not slander one another." Amen. That's a really interesting situation, isn't it? Like, what's that church like? Are you thinking, like, I'm glad I'm not at that church that James was writing to? If he was writing to one particular congregation? Was this just something that was so well known that the people do, that Christians do, the problem that churches face, that within 30, 40, 50 years, we don't know for sure, of Jesus' resurrection, that James says, "Hey, Christians, by the way, when you come together to worship God, when you work together to spread the gospel, when you're in your community defending yourself against outside threats, and you're sort of, you know, supporting one another, and you're caring for the poor in the streets, and you're doing God's work, when all of that's going on, don't slander one another." And you think people go and they go, "Oh, I don't know." They knew that. But sometimes we need to have our behavior given a label, don't we?
Yeah.
Sometimes we need to have our behavior given a label to say, "Oh yes, I am doing that. And I need to stop it, or I need to do it different." The next few lines of the verse, this is the entire verse, and the next few lines, I think, at least to me, are quite confusing as we read it. "Anyone who speaks against a brother or sister or judges them speaks against the law and judges it. When you judge the law, you are not keeping it, but sitting in judgment on it." Usually when we see the law as we read through the New Testament, we think of the Old Testament. Maybe particularly we think of the first five books of the Old Testament. But it seems to me as we read through James that we get to chapter 4, we have to remember what's going on in the first three chapters. And of course, in a sermon series that runs for several months, we've forgotten what was back in chapter 2, right? And so let me just pop it in here, chapter 2 and verse 8. And I think this is what James refers to most of the time when he talks about the law in his letter. So brothers and sisters, do not slander one another. If you really keep the royal law found in Scripture, love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing right. The royal law. That's what his book's about. Okay, that's what this letter's about. And so he comes down and says, anyone who speaks against a brother or a sister or judges them speaks against the law, the royal law of loving their neighbor as themselves, and judges that particular law. And so what often happens when we talk about slander, when we talk about this kind of, maybe it's gossip or speaking ill of one another, is that people don't just come along to church and start spewing hatred. They don't start saying, oh, that person is a terrible person. Rather, they justify their actions, or we justify our actions. Because this is what's best for the church. It's best for the church that Sister Jones not run that ministry. I don't like the way she's running it. It's not good. She's not doing it well. It would be better if someone else ran it, or maybe if I ran it. But it shouldn't be her. And by the way, if the elders knew what Sister Jones did 20 years ago, they'd never trust her to be in charge in the first place. Maybe they don't know. Maybe they should know. Hey, Edie, do you know if the elders know what Sister Jones did 20 years ago? Yeah. How about you, Joan? Do you know what the elders, if the elders know if what Sister Jones did 20 years ago? And we work our way around and we ask, hey, do you know if the elders know? Well, if the elders didn't know, you know what's going to happen before too long? The elders are going to know. And then what's going to happen? And so we justify our slanderous actions that violate the royal law, and we give ourselves an exception. I was completely justified. I didn't make an accusation, I just asked a question. I only put it out there because I'm concerned about that ministry that's so important to the church. I'm just making people aware and they can make their own judgments about that. It's not really slander. This wasn't what James was talking about at all. And so we have this exception. And we say, and so James says, when you judge the law, you're not keeping it. You're sitting in judgment on it. What we're saying is, that law applies to you, but it doesn't apply to me under these circumstances. And so there's a superiority process that's taking on. And so maybe the man that I described in the opening story, perhaps he honestly thought, I'm only shining light on darkness. What I'm doing is best for the church. That preacher is just, the church is never going to grow with him preaching. And he might be right. What if he's right that the church will never grow with that person preaching? I think the issue here is that there are ways of addressing those concerns that don't involve making accusations, don't involve gossip. Don't involve slander. Don't involve going behind people's backs and spreading stories. Because God says there's only one lawgiver. There's only one judge. And when we assume the role of deciding which laws apply to us and which don't, two things are happening. We're assuming we're better than everyone else. In other words, our pride is running rampant. And the second thing is that we're taking over God's job. And that's not a good thing. You don't want to do that. So I feel like when we talk about judging, that I always need to put a disclaimer. I just feel this is the environment, the spiritual church, social environment in which we live. James is not saying that making judgments is wrong. In fact, James is making a judgment. Do you see that? Because he's saying that if you slander, he's going to kind of get down later on, he's going to say you're evil. Right? He's already gone back and said, you know, if you think back to the last chapter about the tongue, you know, and how we use it and the problems we can cause and how it's set on fire by hell itself. Whoa, James, back up. That's getting a bit judgy there. It's not that James isn't able to make a distinction between right and wrong. It's not that elders or leaders in the church shouldn't make decisions about who is an appropriate person to lead a ministry. It's not that judgments themselves are wrong. You all make judgments about, I'm going to worship at Lawson Road because that's a place that I believe I can worship God well, that it'll be good for me spiritually to grow. And so, judgments are necessary. We make judgments about our friends. Are they good for my spiritual life to spend time with that person or as much time with them as I'm doing? But when we start applying double standards, that's when we get in problems. That's why I think if we go back to chapter 1 of James, he talks right at the very beginning about a double-minded person. And we see this idea of double-minded all the way through, of saying, this is the standard for you, but I've got a different one. That law doesn't apply to me, but it does apply to you. And it's no wonder then that churches are regarded as houses of hypocrisy so often. Because we want to apply these standards maybe to people outside the church. Like, oh, you're so bad. And then they see us do something. We're like, well, that's not good. Like, oh, you're going to hell. Well, you think you're going to... And so, well, when that takes place, James is saying, don't do it. What you're actually doing isn't judging the person, you're judging the law. You're judging this, do I love my neighbors as myself? Who do I love? Who are my neighbors? Who am I going to care for? And what's it mean to love them as my... Well, that I'm not going to do that. That's just ridiculous, that as yourself thing. I can't ever love anyone as much as I love myself. I don't have to worry about it. Nah. There's one lawgiver, one judge, one who is able to save and to destroy. And so how are you going to handle this law? How are you going to live it? And then he says at the very end, but you, who are you to judge your neighbor? Amen. Well, yes, James, we are to judge our neighbor. Okay? But we don't take the role of God. We approach them, we talk to them. So much of this is in the practicalities of how it's carried out. Okay? It's whether we see something in somebody's life and we adopt a finger-wagging posture or an arm-around-the-shoulder posture. And so James continues and he writes and he turns his attention to a different group of Christians in the church. And we don't have a lot of information about them, but we know this verse. If you've been around the church for any length of time, I think we're very familiar with this. But they seem to be traveling merchants. Okay? Listen, you guys who say today or tomorrow we'll go to this city, spend a year there, carry on business, make money. Like, for us, that's sort of no big deal. Right? You graduate college, you've got to get your first job, you're like, oh yeah, I'm going to go to Charlotte, and I'm going to, you know, this is going to, and then once I get a nest egg, then I'll come back, or I'll go to wherever, I'll go to New York City, I'll go, like, we make those sort of plans and we travel, and anyone can do it. Right? People didn't travel very much when this was written. You were born in a place, you pretty much stayed in a place. Took money. It was dangerous. But these people are traveling, they've got their mind set on business, they're going to make money, they're going to spend a year there. And so we see them as merchants. And James points the finger at them. I don't know if he's wagging it, but he's certainly pointing it. Maybe there's some wagging going on. We see the trade routes, just to get an idea. I mean, Rome had its roads, it made travel as easy as it could, particularly for its troops, somewhat for its merchants. And they went right across, this is from the second century, but right across the empire. But as these merchants, they would be wealthy in comparison to most of the people in the church. Most of them are just forging out a subsistence, living. And regardless of the details of who these people are, their attitude demonstrates two values that defy their relationship with Jesus, defy their discipleship of Jesus. The first is a focus on materialism. Perhaps they were even connected, if you cast your mind back to worship in the park, we talked there about equality and not honoring those that are wealthy or we might say that are educated or a particular social segment over others. And so perhaps it was these merchants that were connected with that scene described in chapter 2 where they were brought to the front and given a seat of honor while the poor received a place on the floor. But they're focused on making wealth, building businesses. And then the second problem that they demonstrate is that they're making life plans as though life is within their control. Okay. Now, compared to first century Mediterranean basin, our lives are a lot more in our control than theirs. Okay. This afternoon, my family's going to head over towards Utica, and I'm not at all worried about bandits. Armed robbery is just not on my list of concerns this afternoon. I'll have egg on my face if I come back, you know. But that's not something I'm thinking about, except for this sermon illustration. I'm not worried about bears between here and Utica. Mountain lions, you know. All those other terrible things that live in the United States. But if you were traveling in the first century, they were just two of the threats. Never mind the weather that might afflict you before you could get to shelter or other natural disasters that you had limited resources to use to protect yourself. And so we tend to be more secure, more confident when we make plans. Okay. Some of us, no doubt, have sat down with a financial planner at some point in our lives, in our 20s, in our 30s, our 40s, and mapped out the growth of our investments for the next 30, 40 years, set a retirement date out there, and that's where it's going to go. That'll even tell you when you're going to die, right? If you've made it to 55, then you're probably going to die by the time you're fill in the blank. They've got a table for it. Your life is on a mathematical table in a life insurance office over there in Hartford, Connecticut. And so these people were making life plans as though life was within their control. James says, that's not going to work. It's not the attitude to take, and I think we tend to do that even more so than they did. And so I think as we look at these verses, and they're just a short section of James chapter 4. Next week we'll finish the series with James chapter 5. But we see these four temptations. The first temptation is an attitude of superiority, attitude of pride, and assuming God's role as judge. The second cluster there is focusing on wealth and materialism. And as often happens when we focus on finances, we then assume God's role of planning our own life's path. And I think we say, well, I'm putting my faith into action because here's my plan. And I'm putting faith in God to help me carry it out. You see, we dress it up, we make it holy. But God said, no, before you make that plan, you need to spend some time saying, is it God's will? Get that sorted out. And then make plans, and then be willing to adjust them. Because the answer you came up with initially may or may not have been correct. And many times things change as we go through life. The plan for the next 24 months, even if you got that part right, may be different after that than what you think it will be. And so we can summarize this list by saying that they describe situations where we are tempted to take the place of God. We're tempted to take the place of God. Now, none of us woke up this morning and said, you know, today I feel like a God. I'm projecting on the rest of you, okay? Like, I'm presuming you didn't do that. You can let me know afterwards if that's part of your morning routine. And so we think that because I don't have that attitude, when I wake up, maybe these verses don't apply to me. I never think that I'm God. I mean, you know, I can't. Lightning strikes are outside my gift set. But the James reminds us that our attitude sometimes can be awfully godlike. That we start taking things that are God's responsibility and making them ours. Whether they be things of judging others or thinking of ourselves as the master of our own destiny. And we may not even realize that as we say it, as we make these decisions, that we're pushing God to the sideline and elevating ourselves over others. And so I have no problem with Christians who've taken this verse throughout the centuries and they've used the phrase, because James says, rather you should say, if it's in the Lord's will. And so for centuries, Christians have said, if it's in the Lord's will, this is what's going to happen. Well, James really wasn't, I don't believe, particularly concerned with those actual words. But he sure is concerned about the attitude behind them. And I say he's not concerned about the words because it is easy to say God willing, but to be thinking, of course, God is willing. This idea of mine is amazing. God willing. But yeah, God's willing, right? And so we push on through life and we said the right thing and James says, oh, you're so wonderful, you said the right thing. No, James is concerned about what's our attitude towards our life decision making and God. And so James provides a remedy to these temptations that's grounded in an attitude of humility. It's a little morbid, but it's an idea that he introduced way back in chapter 1. He says in chapter 1, I know that you're rich, but don't place your confidence in your wealth. Don't place your confidence in your superiority over others. Don't place your confidence in your business abilities. Don't place your confidence in your education. Don't place your confidence in your career. Don't place your confidence in whatever achievements you have made in your life. He says, life is short like a small plant in the sun or mist that burns off by lunchtime. And all of those things come and go. Like I said, it's a bit morbid, but it provides us with an important perspective. The only thing in life that doesn't come and go. We come and go. Our stuff comes and goes. But God remains the same. And so we can try to take His place, but it won't work. And we're doomed for failure if we think that we can control the curveballs of life. Maybe if we just get enough insurance policies, we'll cover ourselves against car accidents, we'll cover ourselves against ill health, we'll cover ourselves against accidents on the job, we'll cover ourselves, we can even cover ourselves against death. Except we don't get that payout, do we? So James says, don't be boasting in your arrogant schemes. All such boasting is evil. And then as he walks off the stage, it's like he drops the mic. You've seen people do that? You know, it's like, I'm going to do this last thing, say this last thing, and I'll just drop the mic and I'm done. Well, there's a chapter 5 coming. But here at the end of chapter 4, it's like he drops the mic. And you may have read this piece of wisdom that may have given you sleepless nights at some points. Anyone then who knows the good they ought to do and doesn't do it is sin for them. Now, I think that sometimes this verse is used to make us feel completely inadequate. We have a hard enough time, don't we, doing all the things that we're told to do? And don't you just want to throw your hands up in the air and say, God, how can I know to do the things I'm not told to do? The things I don't even know. But I don't think this verse isn't just dropped as a standalone verse. James isn't saying, I want you all to leave today feeling totally inadequate, totally weighed down with guilt, totally having this pressure and responsibility to live a particular way. Rather, the passage, as we go through it as a whole, has addressed symptoms of pride. And it's described how pride prompts people to ignore the royal law, to live for themselves, to slander others, to accumulate wealth, to judge others, to live a life of your own and make decisions for yourself about what's best for you and how your life is going to turn out. And in doing that, we ignore the royal law to love our neighbor as ourselves. James says, and he's talked about this earlier in the passage, and you may want to go back and read this whole chapter this week. I encourage you, put it on your communication card that you'll read James 4 as a whole this week. But he says the answer to all of this is humility. The wise person will commit to serving our neighbors, to loving our neighbors, to doing good for our neighbors. And so if we continue to ignore our neighbors, if we continue to focus on ourselves, we're stepping outside God's will for His children. We're not doing what we know we should be doing. What we should be doing is loving our neighbors. And so, if we know to do good for our neighbors, but we ignore it and we focus on ourselves and we're doing good for ourselves instead of for them, then we're sinning. You can only say, I'm not hurting my neighbors. I'm not doing things to putting fertilizer on their lawn so they have to mow it extra. I'm not putting weed killer on their lawn because they never mow it. Anyway, so it's not about what's your action. Sometimes we just see them hurting, see them suffering, see people around us in the workplace, at school, and we just ignore them. And we say, oh, I love my neighbors. I'm always smiling and saying hi. James says, that's not loving your neighbors. That's like getting through life as easily as you can for yourself. That's making sure that your neighbors don't interrupt the plans that you've made to go to a city to make some money, to live there for a year. Like you're not being like God. You're changing the law for yourself. He says, you know to do better than that. You know to be active. And so it's so easy for us to become smug. It's a good word, isn't it? Smug, so short. But it sort of sounds the way it feels. I'm smug. Okay? I'm better than you. I'm better than the person suffering mental health. I'm better than all the attitudes that Pharisee said. I'm better than the murderer. I'm better than the adulterer. I'm better than the person in jail. I'm better than the person that dropped out of school. I'm better than the person that's the dishonest mechanic. I'm better than... I'm not like them. Thank you, God. It's easy to become too self-reliant and say, God, thank you for all the gifts you've given me. I can do so many things. And it's easy to talk about others as though they're problems and not people. It's easy to get caught up in accumulating wealth. And so at the end of the day, James asks and he says, when your life's going well, how's your relationship with your neighbors? That's what this verse is. That's what this mic drop is. When things are going well for you, how is your relationship with your co-workers? How is your relationship with your neighborhood? How is your relationship with people around you? Because you're to love them as you love yourself. So if life's good for you, are you contributing in a way that makes life good for others? Where's your love? And are you putting it into action? If we can encourage you today in any way, we want to do that. Life is hard sometimes. There are so many ways that our plans get interrupted, right? Sometimes they're good. Sometimes we're going to do a certain thing and we meet the Mr. or Mrs. Magnificent that changes all of our plans. That's a great thing. We get a promotion at work and I was going to go on this vacation. I can't take that vacation because I got this great opportunity. And other times our plans change because of illness, because of heartache, because of just difficulties of all sorts. And so, if we can encourage you, we want to do that. And we'll pray with you and we'll do all that we can to come alongside, put an arm around your shoulder and walk with you through those difficult times. If you've never trusted your life to God, because ultimately that's what that verse is about. It says, hey, you want to make a trip, you want to go somewhere. It's like, well, don't do it on your own. Take God with you. And so if you're saying, I've never made that decision to take God with me, I've always done it on my own. If that's not working out for you, then ultimately it won't. And I encourage you to come and we'll talk about what it means to make God part of your life. If you don't talk to me, we're going to have this song coming up and it's the opportunity to just come and share with the church. But you can catch me or someone else you trust after worship and have that conversation. Let's stand and let's sing together.